Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to part two of the French Connection. My name again is Daryl Bradford Smith. It is the 7th day of April 2006, and as described in the first segment of the French Connection today, we have a guest. Her name is Jennifer Dixon. She has written a book called The Holy Land Unveiled. It is a book about her travels through the Holy Land, and she came back with some very clear impressions that she subsequently researched and documented and found statistics to back up her beliefs that certain things that the American public believe about that region are fabrications. And so today we're going to talk a little bit about her experiences of going to the Holy Land and what she saw when she was there and how over time her opinion about what she saw there has changed. So, Jennifer, are you with me?
I am.
Nice to have you here, Jennifer.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you. And, in fact, you told me earlier that your first trip to this region, you went there without any preconceived notions. You kind of went there as an opportunity to experience that region, and you went on a religious trip, I think you said.
It was a trip with a religious group, but it also was a political trip, so it was both. We went to see the Holy Land sites that everyone goes to, Bethlehem and Jerusalem, Nazareth, the Galilee, things you've heard if you come from a Christian background, you've heard about all your life. So that was one side of it. But the other was to see the situation with Palestinians, and that was very shocking to me. It was just startling. I walked into a country where I was living in a total police state. I can remember being there. It was a Christmas time. And being in the square at Bethlehem. And the whole square was just lined with tanks. And that was, and you saw this oppressed people just kind of squirreling around from one little dark hovel to another because that's how they live. I mean, that's how they've been living for decades.
Mm. Well, you know, I've been aware of the plight of the Palestinian people for a very long time, and this show has done a great deal of work, on the Balfour documents and the founding of that region and how people like Menachem Begin used terrorism to eject those people with the Haganah and all of the different criminal groups that sprung out of the formation of Israel back in the late 40s.
Before.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's when they really employed their whole game. But, I mean, this was a largely Rothschild-financed endeavor, wasn't it?
From other people's research, yeah. The thing that Americans think about Israel-Palestine, the general impression I think that they have is that it was sort of created after World War II, and it was in answer to the Holocaust. In fact, you bring up the Balfour Declaration. That was written in 1917.
Mm.
And at that time, and this is something that people don't know, Jews occupied about 8% of, they constituted 8% of the population of what was then the Palestinian Mandate. And the British did not even rule it. So the British generously gave away, because of their relationship to the Rothschild Bank, they gave away somebody else's country to people who were a very tiny percentage.
Mm-hmm.
And then as the flooding of refugees or European Jews from Europe started in the 20s and the 30s, and that's where they increased the population up to 33%. But even when the UN gave the area 55%, I don't know the exact figure, but that's it, more than half of that space to the Zionists, they still were only 33% of the population. They got 55%. They got the best land. They got the sea coast. They got the wheat fields in the Galilee. They got the Negev, which is very mineral rich. And the Palestinians were sitting there going, for God's sakes, what are you doing? I mean, you're just giving our country over.
Well, what happened? Well, they had really
had arrived.
Well, they had very poor representation in the UN during that period, didn't they?
Well, they had none.
None.
Because, the British just betrayed them totally.
Yeah.
The Palestinians had tried to organize themselves in the 30s politically, and the British outlawed their organizations. And then, again, people associate, of course, terrorism with Palestinians. In fact, the Haganah, which was the first terrorist organization in Palestine, was Zionist, and it started in 1921.
That's right.
So attacks on these people go way, way back, and it's been constant, and it's never been represented that way. But even more, another spin that the story has gotten here is that the Israelis bought the land, and here are these spoils for it coming back, you know, when they'd left. In fact, they owned 8% of the land in 1948.
Mm-hmm.
And they got the land by military assault.
That's right.
And confiscation of land.
Mm-hmm.
And if the Palestinians left, which people do, any civilian leaves a war zone unless they're crazy, they run like hell. They just confiscated the land. And they gave themselves a right through law to take the land of Palestinians. And so they did.
And well, and I understand that the Haganah used horrible mutilations and dismemberments and disembowelments to frighten the crowd of Palestinians out of the land. In fact, they were so brutal that the civilian population of Palestinians were absolutely almost dead with fear.
Well, they were. They were. This is how it happened. I mean, people who know a little bit about this refer to Deir Yassin, which is a village that was destroyed in exactly the manner you mentioned. The population was terrorized. People were burned inside their homes. Pregnant women were disemboweled in the street. It was vicious. It was brutal. But in addition to that, 400 villages and cities in Palestine at that time, which was what the Palestinians refer to as al-Nakba, were just either destroyed militarily or occupied. So it was a wholesale slot on the civilian population. And they were streaming, I mean, obviously, streaming out of Palestine because there was no army there. They had no way to protect themselves.
Yeah.
So what is depicted as seven big Arab armies coming, you know, to get the poor little fledgling Jewish state was not exactly that. It was, in fact, the Israelis who attacked the Palestinians within the areas that were assigned to the Israelis because Palestine was so Palestinian that even that area was half Arab. And the Zionist agenda was simply to get rid of them.
Yeah.
So they attacked them, and then they fled. And then this happened in 47. It started in 47.
Yeah.
And the Arab response to that was not until May of 48. And it was, in fact, they were one-to-one, the Arab armies and the Israeli, at the beginning. And after 3 months, the Israeli army was 30% bigger than the Arab, the assembled Arab armies, which were just pathetic because they'd been a colonized people anyway. They didn't have access to arms.
Well, actually, so, in advance of this, the Jewish community there was allowed to have weapons, and the British confiscated the Palestinians' weapons when they came in and gave the land. So the civilian population of Palestinians was unarmed, and the Jewish population had plenty of weapons.
Yeah, they had cachets. They had cachets from the Czechoslovakians, gave them state-of-the-art weaponry at that point. So, yeah, they were very armed, very funded, and, of course, the Palestinians weren't.
Yeah.
They were really an agrarian nation, which is another thing that a misconception that people have. Palestine was very settled. It wasn't a bunch of Bedouin, and it wasn't a bunch of guys on camels. It was an agrarian nation with a deep history that goes back thousands of years. Jerusalem has been a center of both Muslim and Christian learning and religious activity for hundreds of years.
Thousands.
And actually, Jerusalem was under the Muslims for 1,200 years before the Zionists decided to take it over. So, they had homes, they had mosques, they had schools, they had farms, they had quarries.
But here's an interesting thing that most people don't know. About 25% of Palestinians are actually not Islamic. They're Christian. They have Christian Palestinians, just like the Lebanese have Christians, just like many communities of Christians live throughout that region. And in fact, the Israelis did not discriminate. They killed people indiscriminately, whether they were Palestinian Christians or Palestinian Muslims.
That's true. That is true. Well, of course, Palestine was the birthplace of Jesus Christ, so it's the origin of Christianity.
Yeah.
So there had to have been some Christians there. And there were. I don't know what the percentage was at that time. Now its majority is Muslim. The Christians left, by and large, because they tended to be the more moneyed classes, and they were able to escape.
Yeah,
so,
that's right.
And they are leaving now Bethlehem, not because of conflicts with the Muslims, but because Israel has built a great big wall through the city of Bethlehem and destroyed it.
Yeah.
As they are just intentionally destroying whatever economy the Palestinians might pull together.
Well, they just all the aid going there recently was just cut, and so there actually is a huge risk right now of serious starvation, and we already know that their hospitals are in dire need of certain medications, that insulin is falling short in supply. It's just a mess. Their economy is ground to a halt.
The economy in Palestine is so bad that people are living, and this is according to the World Bank. In the West Bank, 50% of the people are living on $3.60 a day or less. In the Gaza, that figure goes up to 80%. The Gaza is really faced with starvation.
Yeah.
They are getting no aid. The UN, which has been keeping them going, has actually been cutting aid. And this is something that people don't know. They were getting $200 in the 90s, $200 from the UN per individual, you know, as aid. Now that's down to $70 per individual. That's for a year.
Yeah.
This is a place where there is the water table has been completely destroyed. It is full of fecal matter, lead, pesticides. The Israelis purposely cut the water so it won't go there. So it's really just a little, you know, mud. And they're isolated. They cannot grow sufficient food there for themselves. So the so-called disengagement was just a chance for Israel to pull out and be able, because they don't have citizens in the area, to bomb at will.
This is a genocide, isn't it, Jennifer?
It is genocide. It is actually genocide. It's a slow genocide. And it's a genocide that has, in fact, been taking place for decades. And that's what people don't understand. And the Palestinians are reduced to that level of poverty. They were a farm exporting nation until 67.
Yeah.
They were, you know, to Europe, what Florida, California to the United States. Olives, oranges, lemons, dates, figs, grapes, Palestinian wine. Now, I mean, they can hardly feed themselves. The arable land has been reduced by intention, by Israeli policy, from 28% of the land of the West Bank to 3%.
Mm-hmm.
So, plus, they're taking the water. They take 85% of the water on the West Bank, drill it, deep drill, and suck it out for the settlers and for Israel proper. And then they control the water for the Palestinian villagers.
Well, you know, I'm looking
all they have to do is turn the faucet.
I'm looking at this mess, and of course it is a genocide. You mentioned in your book how many checkpoints there are in this place. Now, you could actually have a brother and a sister or parents and children separated by a checkpoint where they cannot go to see one another.
And that is exactly how they live. There are 672 checkpoints in an area, imagine between Washington and New York, and that's even a greater distance, but I mean 672 checkpoints. Well, you'd be stopping every 15 minutes.
If that long, it would take you 5 minutes probably.
So you can't get anywhere in place. And they close them arbitrarily. You never know why. All of a sudden, you know, you just wake up one day and you can't get from Ramallah to Jerusalem. And in fact, people living on the West Bank are not allowed to go to Jerusalem. It's against the law. You can't have property, even though your family has owned property in Jerusalem and, say, on the West Bank. You can't have both pieces of property because you can't travel. Then you become an absentee landlord, and then they take the property away from you. And that's how the law works there. So there are no civil liberties. There are no civil rights for Palestinians. They can't be property owners. They can't travel.
What do we think? Interestingly enough, our representative to the United Nations happens to be Jewish. Is that a surprise to you, Jennifer?
It isn't, because the entire negotiating team during the Clinton years was headed by Dennis Ross, and most of the team was Jewish, and they were Zionists, and they were in favor of Israel, and that was obvious. And, of course, they had the weight of this our empire against Palestinians, and what the Palestinians they would come to the negotiating table with number two pencils and a pad, and, you know, the Zionist crowd here had a, you know, legal system, computer banks, etc. I mean, it was just, it's not negotiation. You don't negotiate between the powerless and the extremely powerful. So, which is another deception, you know, that the Palestinians are thwarting any attempt of the Israelis to negotiate with them, and they're undermining it with their violence. And this is really the biggest deceit.
Yeah, that's a bold-faced lie, in fact.
Yeah, it is a bold-faced lie. And this, the figure that I'm going to quote right now is from an organization called Betzalem. That is an Israeli human rights organization. And they keep track of deaths, relative deaths between Palestinians and Israelis.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that there are four times as many Palestinians dying in this conflict of the last 5 years, the Intifada, as Palestinians.
As Israelis,
they acknowledge
mm-hmm.
that the death toll is four times greater on the Palestinian side. Of course, you don't see this in any paper in this country. But in addition to that, I did a little deeper research and found out that the Israeli army does not include people they call militants, the Palestinian militants, and they don't include suicide bombers in their statistics. So in other words, they include their own combatants in the statistics, but they don't include the Palestinians, you know, trying to defend the West Bank. Because all this violence goes on in the West Bank, 90% of it.
Well, it's also
the Palestinian occupied area.
Well, they've got some false flag organizations there too, don't they? I mean, the Israelis are actually backing the Islamic Jihad, aren't they?
I have heard that. I don't absolutely know. I think they enable them.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the things that I did notice, I was in Jerusalem. I traveled with a journalist from east to west Jerusalem, east Jerusalem being the Palestinian side, not for long because they've taken control of that too, but to west Jerusalem, which is Israeli-dominated. And we went over there. Now, he's Palestinian, and but he's a Israeli Arab. That means he lives inside Israel, and they're about 20% of the people in Israel are Arab, and they're secondary citizens. But anyway, he lives there. We traveled into West Jerusalem, and he was frisked every single door, at every single door.
Mm-hmm.
He was thoroughly frisked. So I have to wonder how it is that anybody loaded down with all these belts of weapons and bombs around their body can travel from the West Bank over to the coast, over to, you know, that's in a place that's just full of checkpoints, because Israel itself, of course, is full of armed guards. They're everywhere. You don't travel anywhere. You don't go into a bank, a restaurant, anywhere without seeing these people. So
it's a giant mafia is what it is.
It's just bizarre. It was the weirdest one of the... God, I mean, I went there, and to start off with, I mean, they terrify the hell out of you. I went in through the Jordan side. There is an entrance into, and there are very few of them, because
mm-hmm.
it's heavily guarded. I went in through the Allenby Bridge, and that's on the Jordan side, and I was one of the very few Westerners. So they process all the people. You have to get off the bus, take all the luggage off. They examine everything piece by piece. It takes the whole day. You're waiting and waiting and waiting, and people are being hauled off and questioned. And then I was one of those people who was being hauled off and questioned. And they did this for a couple of hours. And
what did they ask you? What kind of questions did they ask you?
What was I doing there? Who did I know in Amman? Where did I stay in Amman? Who I was going to go see? What I was going to do? And just on and on and on, and why, and they looked my passport, and why were you, I had been in Egypt, why were you in Egypt? So I just answered neutrally, and then at a certain point I said, you know, when am I going to be let go? I have reservations, I need to move on. So they backed off a little. So if you talk them down, if you don't let them intimidate you, they'll back off a bit. At least they did that time. Of course, on the other hand, they throw Americans in jail.
They do.
There. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I would be less likely to with a name like Dixon. But any Arab American, bingo, in the jail. And they keep them there.
Well, do you remember the Rachel Corrie incident? Were you privy to any of the stuff that went on around her, a murder?
Only what I've seen. I do know that she was intentionally murdered. They are trying to pass it off as an accident. But actually, there were kids there screaming to this bulldozer to stop. She had tripped. She was there in one of these bright orange garb. They had to have noticed. And then when they pulled the bulldozer back, they didn't lift the blade. So they intentionally hauled this blade back over her. And she was dead within a couple of hours.
Yeah.
So that was no accident. And that, you know, was a warning. They also killed Tom Herndell, the journalist, the British journalist over there. I mean, he was waving a white flag. So, you know, as a matter of fact, 50 journalists have been targeted there in the last couple of years. That's the last figure I have. I know that 14 of them died.
Well, so these people are murderers.
Mm-hmm.
They're genocidal, homicidal maniacs.
Mm-hmm.
They're bent on world domination. They've got financing from the people doing the same horrible things to America, and using their, in fact, Dov Zolkheim, a known radical Zionist, has fleeced America for trillions, shipped it over to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
We're in a mess, aren't we, Jennifer?
We're in a big mess.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny you mentioned the thing about the trillions. One thing I didn't know about that, but I did know in 2002 that Israel was capable of flying the same number of sorties, that is military flights, in the Middle East as the U.S. military was. I mean, this is a country of 5-6 million people with a military like this?
Yeah.
It's crazy. And, of course, where have our trillions of dollars gone? To pay for it.
Sure.
And if you want to see what a military state is like, you go there. If you have the guts for it.
Well, they would kill me there in about 2 seconds.
10 seconds, yeah.
I don't think 10. I think as soon as I even got on any of the LL planes, I would be dead. But the interesting thing is that we're looking at... I mean, I've had other people on the show who've also been... Dr. McGowan went,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And his story is to my listeners was that they were far more racist and far more apartheid than South Africa ever dreamt of being, and that this was the most apartheid country probably in world history.
Well, I've never seen anything like it. The original inhabitants are just being shoved out of the way. And everything that is there belongs to Israel.
Now, aren't the Israelis ashamed?
They went into the law, and God, the abuse of these people.
Doesn't the Israeli population, the Jewish side of that ledger, aren't they ashamed of themselves? Aren't they aware of what's happening in their name?
I don't know. I spent most of the time that I was there on the Palestinian side, on the West Bank, to get a feel for what went on. I did talk to some Scottish women who were there with one of the peace groups, and a lot of people go in there individually to try to help because Palestinians are so poor. But they had been with this group called Checkpoint Watch, and the attitude of the women was they didn't want their soldiers on the West Bank because they would degrade themselves by lowering themselves to the level of Palestinians. So that sounds pretty racist to me. And these are the people who are supposedly helping the Palestinians. I'm not saying that all the Israelis think that way. Others of them, certain groups like Jeff Halper's group against home demolitions, genuinely see that this is just horrific, and you just cannot treat other people like this. But, again, I don't know if their population is voting these governments in. Either they are brainwashed themselves, or they simply don't want to know.
What happened
and
when
I
you
think
were...
a lot of it is just people don't want to know.
What happened when you returned to America and started sharing your exploits? Did people turn away from you as though you were the problem rather than telling them a truthful story? I mean, they probably felt right away that knee-jerk reaction that most people, when they hear me speak about evil Jewish leadership, they immediately get this Pavlovian kind of response. What kind of response did you receive?
I have received a lot of responses like that, but what is very obvious to me is people are uncomfortable. They don't want me to talk about it. They'll let me say a couple of things, and then quickly the conversation is turned to other subjects.
Mm.
Or people will read it and go, I mean, they'll be horrified when you read everything in that book, because it's so different than what people think, that they just, at first they agree, and then after 2 or 3 days, some sort of process, you know, some rationalization process starts to kick in, and they begin, you know, to blame Hamas or whatever the usual things are. They can't somehow take it into their brain. And it's, I mean, I understand that, because until you go there, you really can't believe it. I mean, I had done research, but I had been, by being there that you really, you can see it. I mean, you can see the condition of these people living in their little, you know, cement hovels with a fluorescent light hanging in the cold. And then you go look over to Israel and it's, you know, skyscrapers and Blockbuster and state-of-the-art this, that, and the next thing, and yeah. This is an absolute...
I don't need to go there to know that monsters are running the place. I've seen their handiwork in the last century. They murdered 100 million with their deeds. And you know, through the Balfour years and into World War II. And when you start looking at the criminality behind the Nazi regime, you find Zionist Jews behind many, many, many elements within the Nazi movement. So this stuff is not surprising to me, and I know what monsters can be. And the reason I'm fighting this fight is because, you know, when you see it happening to someone else, your first thought is, well, it couldn't happen to me.
Mm.
Well, that's a lie. And see, anybody not willing to fight for their freedom is going to be losing it pretty quickly. And I think Americans have turned into a bunch of mushy ne'er-the-wells that couldn't fight their way out of a paper bag for the most part because they've become fat and happy. And all of a sudden, I think they really are under threat, and they can't even wrap their brain around the threat that they face.
Well, they don't know what it is.
They don't, no.
You know, I mean, I'm learning more and more, and I'm not sure what it is, but I know that this is not the society that I thought it was, you know, growing up.
Yeah.
And I see it become stranger and stranger, and people becoming, just turning their attention away from reality.
Yes, that's right.
They do not want to deal with it. And
no,
and the Middle
East
reality is the big one. Americans aren't going to face it. Just not going to talk about it, and if it's somebody else's problem.
Yeah.
That's the thinking. Well, it's not. It is most certainly the problem of people in the Middle East. But they know what's happening to them.
Yeah. Well, the media has done this, and we talked about this in our private conversation, and I'm sure you have more than just a few comments about how the media has done this to us, but what are some of your more salient points regarding the American media's treatment of this and how you see they've used their dominance of our media to spin their own lies? I mean,
well, again, it's totally misrepresented, and it has become obvious to me that it's intentionally so.
Oh,
somebody
yeah.
did a very good study about how the media covered the violence in Palestine, Israel, and she tracked this for a year. She studied the New York Times and then also the electronic media, CBS, NBC, CNN, etc., the big stations. What she found was in the year that, I think it was 2004, I should get my exact figures, in 2004, there were 176 Palestinian children killed.
Yeah.
In that same year, there were 8 Israeli children killed. Yet, the New York Times reported on the death of Israeli children 7 times as much as they reported on the death of Palestinian children.
Yeah.
So, in other words, you're taking this huge multiple of deaths on the Palestinian side and converting it by over-coverage and of Israeli death and complete neglect or large neglect of the Palestinian death and making it seem again that the poor Israelis are the victims of these irrational Palestinians.
Yeah.
And in the electronic media and in this country, I think people are much more likely to pick up their news by the TV, through the TV or radio, but TV primarily in the evening. The coverage was 13 times as much. I think CBS was 13 times as much. That was the worst. The other ones were like 11 times as much, 12 times.
Yeah,
as much.
Lawrence Tisch and Haley's network. Yeah, you know the facts are. And here's the interesting thing: when you go across America today, and you look at the endowments in major universities for journalism,
mm-hmm.
all this journalism schools. If you take a look at the name on top of the school, who gave the money?
Mm-hmm.
It has come from a Jewish philanthropy.
Mm-hmm.
So what they call philanthropy, they stole the money in the first place, and then they turn around and give it back, and then they control the flow of journalists, and they control the flow of information,
mm-hmm.
they control the networks themselves, they control the debate in the universities, they control through their bludgeoning people who try to go against them with the moniker of anti-Semite. Mm-hmm. So what we see here is a concerted effort to destroy any resistance or any even modicum of factual evidence to the contrary. And I have to tell you, this is beginning to change. I am watching on the net. I'm watching on the net, Jennifer, where you know, the number of treatments of the truth has gone up exponentially.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The net is the salvation of us, if there's going to be one. If people will get beyond reading the net and do something about it. I mean, right now it may be the stage where people are going, "What is going on?" What, you know? And they're, it's just a bit of shock involved.
Yeah.
Because as I began to open my mind, like, trust me, I mean, I was in shock. I really was. I would begin to learn things and just, it, none of it computed. It didn't fit into what my little worldview was. So that's hard.
Well, how did you find your way to the French Connection?
You know, I don't remember. I really don't. I mean, I was on the net. I was looking for alternative sources of news and seeing who said what, and I found you somehow. I don't even remember.
Well, we're lucky that you did, and I got to tell you, you know, this fight is nowhere near won. In fact, if I were a betting man, it's certainly going to be a pitched battle for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, it's going to take an effort from the people who have awoken to these facts to start making an extra effort, because I've asked people that listen to this programming to bring one person a week,
right,
to make it their goal to find an individual, one. And now I'm saying to them at this hour, at this moment, that people are becoming more open to these truths right now. Your harvesting of participants is going to be a lot easier than it was 6 months ago or even 6 weeks ago. What's happening is, as the gates of truth start to open, people will become willing to look at these truths. And so you may not have the resistance you're expecting. I think you're going to start finding people more and more willing to see this stuff for what it is.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I sense a difference. And I also actually do something you recommended, which is I put it out there, and then that's it. And they can absorb it at their rate. I don't push people. People resent that.
Yeah.
People who are confused anyway and trying to sort it out for themselves don't want to be pushed.
Yeah.
But they will come to it because it's, I mean, people are terrified of what's going on. What is this thing with Iran? Another war? More war? You know, bomb Iran, bomb this country, bomb that. When is this going to come to an end? What is going on with the economy? The gas prices are insane.
Yeah.
People are scared now.
Yeah, they are.
They should
and well, they should be. And if I'll tell you something, if they knew what these people have in store for us, they'd be more than scared. They would be in a full-fledged panic. And I, you know, I'm not here to panic the public, mm-hmm. but I certainly want people to go about recruiting new listeners as though their life depended on it, because, frankly, it does, you know.
Yeah, it does. But, you know, of course, the question I have for you is, I don't understand why this agenda is taking place. It doesn't, I mean, Israeli leaders have said they want a state from the Euphrates to the Nile. They've never, I mean, it's never reported here, but they've been very clear about it. And they're doing exactly that right now. And they're consolidating their control on the West Bank. They've got these people locked into a prison, 300 settlements, connected by Jewish-only roads. Palestinians take these little dirt roads, you know, that's kind of out of the time of the Roman Empire. And they have a huge military arsenal over there. They have stated publicly they're not giving up the Jordan Valley, which means that the Palestinians are trapped between the couple faces of this wall. And the wall does not protect Israelis. It goes right down the middle of the West Bank. It provides a shooting gallery because it's lined every couple hundred yards with these towers, these watchtowers with high-tech weaponry. So, okay, they have done that. But then what? And what? I mean, I don't get it. I mean, it's an insane idea that you can cleanse an entire population. But you can in today's world. You can.
Well, you can. You can if you control the financial system, the organs of the press, and the flow of history. And they have created their own opportunity in these three regards, and then they have their very well oiled machine to put forth against anybody who tries to inhibit these plans. Now, I've told you the plans are basically, if you go, the Lubavitch is the key here, the Shibad Lubavitch, mm-hmm. which is talking about the Messiah coming and being reinstated at the Temple Mount. But they are planning on running the world from a single government in the Middle East. And in order to get this done, they need to implode America. Why? America is one of the few nations on Earth where the public and the citizenry possess weapons of their own. Now, when you think of America with 300 million people, and there are more than one gun in private hands for every single human being in the nation, mm-hmm. that is a huge arsenal. Mm-hmm. And what they're afraid of, and what they've always been afraid of, is that the resistance from America would end up thwarting their plans. The Europeans, by and large, have been defanged, as it were, when, after the Second War and the First mm-hmm. War. They took guns out of private hands. Britain, you couldn't find a gun if you had your life dependent on it. You wouldn't be able to find one. So the Americans were. How were they going to get America with its, decent education system and decent? I mean, what they had to do is they had to destroy the health of the country, both emotionally, mentally. So if you listen to Charlotte Iserbeet the other day on the show, she told you that they deliberately dumbed down the nation. And if you start taking a look at who controls these people yeah. writing the curriculum, it's the same group.
Yeah.
And you start looking at the conspiracy, and it's just all flowing in the same direction. And I got to say, you know, this conversation we're having, we're not necessarily, digging up new information, except that we're representing it for people so that they can consume this in a different way. We know these people are bad. We know what they're doing, yet we still are shocked by the truth when we hear it. Mm-hmm. We're still shocked.
Yeah, because the truth is shocking. It's awful. And when you see that, at least for me, I mean, Americans live right now, I mean, you look at America and there's still a lot of suburbs and the sun is shining and everybody's running around the mall and buying all the little doodads and trinkets. But you go to a place like the Middle East or you go to Israel, Palestine, and you see people who live under brutal military occupation and what it does to them. You know, it's frightening.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the human spirit can only stand so much.
Yeah.
And it can ground down.
I think some of those horrors are actually going to visit America soon, and I hate having to believe my own statement, but I really do believe it. All the indications are that it's going to happen probably sooner rather than later. And why? Because I think part of their agenda is being advanced as a result of people like myself and you and others who are starting to really force their hand. They don't have the margin they used to have where they could move. At their leisure, they have to start taking control of things because it's getting out of their control, I believe.
Certainly forces in the world are reacting to it because they have to.
They do.
I mean, I know that the Iraq oil is being shuttled into Haifa, so that's a big pot. I mean, this is what Israel is going to control, and they control the water. And they made a play for the Suez. Nobody ever brings that up. But Israel is located right up next to the Suez Canal, and that's one of the main trading necks. You know, could be a bottleneck, could be, you know. But anyway, a hell of a lot of the world's trade goes through there.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of oil goes through there. So if they get their hands on that, and then certainly Egypt, I don't think can stand up to them anymore.
Well, they bought and paid for it, just like Jordan.
Yeah, they are. And they're weakened anyway. I mean, what military they had was destroyed in 3 decades ago. But when you begin to control all that, but it's being done carefully. I mean, it's sort of being done out of the sight of people, so they don't see that is what's happening. But they'll find out when the oil prices jump to $10 here, or the gas prices at the tank go up $10 in the U.S. They're going to be mighty surprised in their Hummers.
Well, yeah, and you know, the interesting thing, I got to tell you, I think that the visitation of terror and terrible stuff is actually going to be far more broad than just gas prices hitting $10. It's going to be a multiple of different sicknesses that hit America. And you know, interesting, when I go back to America, I haven't been back in a while because of my political position. But I saw a public who is disgusted with itself. They're in the worst health I've ever seen any country. Mm-hmm. Obesity at 60%.
Mm-hmm. It's incredible.
We're raising literal imbeciles in our school system. We're talking about no engineers being brought out of our universities. We don't manufacture anything anymore. It looks like the infrastructure of the country is in absolute shambles.
That's all true. I mean, the cities I did, I don't anymore, live in Washington, D.C., and that city's unmanageable. I mean, the lights used to go out all the time. The gas mains blow up.
It's like a third world country.
It's like a third world country. And this is the capital of the United States. I didn't want to be there. I don't want to be in a city that's run that badly.
No.
I mean, I didn't feel safe there.
Well, and interesting, I told you.
Yeah, because, I mean, it was once a beautiful city. I know Eric doesn't think so.
Well,
part of it was. Part of it was really.
But, you know, the Americans think still, this is how, and this is the arrogance. They still think that they're the toughest, the biggest, the fastest, the smartest, the most technologically advanced.
Mm-hmm.
And did you know like 80% of America has never been to Europe? I think it's 88%. I've never left the country.
It's still that high, I know. No, it's very isolated. I mean, I went to the Scandinavian countries. They're far more advanced than this country. Far more.
Oh, well, the French are as well, and so are the Germans, and so are the Italians. I mean, you can get on a train, and I mean, I can get on a train and go 500 miles in 2.5 hours.
Yeah, not here. You can't get on a train and go anywhere. I mean, the cities are a mess. There's no public transportation in the cities. Washington, D.C. makes its money by ticketing parked cars.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the cash flow, and that's what the police do. And that is just about the only service they provide. I mean, this is pathetic. It's truly sad that it's just turned into this. But there are a lot of things. Even when I was there, I noticed, you know, the change in the government. Washington was always a transient city. But now what you've got is this mass of people that come in there for short-term jobs so they can pick up a government contract. And that'll be their ticket to success and the big cash flow, and then they'll move out. And they'll go, you know, get their cash cow and settle and find their beautiful place someplace. Well, meanwhile, I mean, it's just talk about special interests. The government's just controlled by money, and it doesn't provide anything. I mean, there are a lot of stupid programs that seem to be ineffectual, and we don't have schools that work. We don't have a medical system.
Yeah.
And I went to a dentist to stay in my existence. But anyway, this guy charged me $300 for an assessment.
$300 for an assessment?
For an assessment, for a patient evaluation. That's greed.
That's out of control. You know what it costs to see a dentist here for a full thing? $25.
Yeah, well.
Well, anyway, look, you know what? We're reaching the end of our little talk here, and there is going to be another re-invite for you. I'll call you in advance to talk to you about some specifics in your book that I'd like you to maybe do some research.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm inviting you personally to become a member of our MySpace group and maybe think about mentoring some of our young people. You know, they are the people going to inherit this mess from us.
Yeah.
And I think one of the great goals of the French Connection is to try to inform the next generation just what they've got in store for themselves there.
Yeah, good idea. I would be happy to do that. I will have a website soon. And my website's a little different than others. It's going to be a slow website. There's a lot of pictures and a lot of information. And I want people to just take their time and absorb it. Because we live in a world where everybody's going too fast all the time. And I intentionally did this so people could just see what's happened in the Middle East. Take a real, honest look at this. You know.
Well, you know, you've been a wonderful...
Then make up your mind. But anyway. Yeah.
You've been a wonderful guest, Jennifer. And your name is Jennifer Dixon. She's written a wonderful book called... Well, it's not a wonderful book. It's sad, but it's quite pointed and powerful. The Holy Land Unveiled. You will be able to get that book from her, or you'll be able to buy an electronic copy. There will be details on the site when your site comes up, so you can get all this stuff. And we'll stay in touch with you so that we can make sure we can provide this for our listeners. But it's been wonderful to have you, Jennifer.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks a bunch, and I'll be talking to you soon.
Okay.
Bye-bye
okay.
Now. Ladies and gentlemen, that was Jennifer Dixon, and I have to tell you that she just did a great job of this interview. And, you know, first-person accounts are always the most powerful because, you know, when you talk about your personal experiences in this world, There is a power that comes from your words, and you can sense the strength and the pathos and the different points trying to be made. And I applaud Jennifer's efforts to try to get these truths out. Anyway, that is our show for the Friday edition of The French Connection. We will try to bring you interesting and powerful interviews here on The French Connection, so stay tuned to us. If not, for the audio files, go to our news part and make sure you read some of our articles, guys. Ben Friedman. Download it, send it around. Until next time, Daryl Bradford Smith saying be well.